You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation. This is Lecture 6, given on the 22nd of August, 1910, entitled Elemental Existence and the Spiritual Beings Behind It, Jehovah Elohim. During these lectures, I shall try to throw light on the Genesis story of creation from all kinds of different aspects. As with all such presentations, we must never lose sight, of course, of our anthroposophical principles, of which the first and foremost is to inquire into the facts of spiritual life. So, too, what is of primary importance as regards the Genesis story is to ascertain what were the supersensible events, the supersensible facts which preceded the visible course of Earth's evolution. Only after that do we attach special importance to finding confirmed in ancient documents of various ages and peoples what we have first established independently of any documents, out of spiritual research itself. In fact, it is our own endeavors which enable us to acquire the right feeling, the proper attitude of reverence for what sounds into our innermost souls from far-off times and peoples. This connection affords us the possibility of reacquainting ourselves with those times which we ourselves will, of course, have lived in during other incarnations, and of reforming links with what must have affected us in past epochs. This is how we have to understand the underlying purpose of this course of lectures. We have endeavored in the past few days to form an idea of how to rediscover in Genesis the spiritual beings we know from spiritual science. We have already partly succeeded in this. We have constantly borne in mind that the things which we meet with in the outer world, even what we meet with on the lower levels of clairvoyant consciousness, and in Genesis we are basically dealing all the time with facts of clairvoyant consciousness, are Maya, illusion. That our usual view of the sense world, as we first of all know it, is Maya, illusion. This is a statement which is familiar to anyone who has anything to do with spiritual science. In fact, anyone who has studied spiritual science for any length of time will not be ignorant of the fact that the lower regions of clairvoyance, everything to do with the etheric and astral world, also belong in a higher sense to this sphere of illusion. We do not reach the actual foundation of existence, as far as we can attain it, until we have penetrated beyond these regions of life's deeper sources. We must keep reminding ourselves of this, and we must not be content merely to voice this as a theory. The conviction must get right into our flesh and blood that in clinging to external existence we are surrendering to illusion. On the other hand, to ignore outer existence, to prize it too highly, is also one of the great illusions to which human beings can succumb. Let us now have a look at something we have been talking a great deal about over the last few days, namely the realm of the elements, which is the next realm we can reach behind the physical realm, the one we perceive with our physical senses. Let us have a look at the realm of the elements described by spiritual science as existing behind manifestations of the nature of earth, water, air, fire or warmth, and the more ethereal manifestations of the nature of light, sound, and life. Let us look at this elemental realm. We try to acquire ideas about the nature of these manifestations, and to keep firm hold of these ideas. We achieve nothing if we assume an air of intellectual superiority, which can very easily become widespread among theosophical devotees, and simply say, quote, "That is all Maya, of course," close quote. For the real beings are revealing themselves through this Maya. And if we refuse to pay any attention to the manifestations, if we spurn getting to know anything about the tools and instruments through which they reveal themselves, we have no means of making existence comprehensible. We must realize that when we say water, air, and so on, we are referring to expressions, to manifestations of real spirituality. But if we refuse to have anything to do with this Maya, we shall not have the least idea about what is there behind it. So it is essential for us to realize fully that the series of elements are expressions, manifestations, revelations of spiritual beings. Let us have a look now, from the anthroposophical point of view, at the earthly element. We know well enough by now that there was no question of there being anything of the nature of an earthly element on ancient Saturn, nor on ancient Sun nor ancient Moon. We know that evolution had to wait until our planet came into existence before the earth element could be added to the warmth element of Saturn, the air element of Sun, and the water element of Moon. We know that each step in evolution can only proceed through the work of spiritual beings. If we want to place the physical body, the lowest member of our human existence, in the life of the elements, we may say that it has made its way from the first rudiments which it acquired on ancient Saturn, from the state of warmth, through the state of air on Sun, through the state of water on Moon, and progressed as far as the present Earth state. Thus we have in our own external physical body something of which we can say that it has passed through an existence of weaving warmth, an existence as an air-like body, an existence as a watery body, and has progressed as far as an earthly existence. We know, too, who the beings were who took part in the work on ancient Saturn, fashioning the first evolutionary condition of the human physical body. Remember what I presented in Title and Outline of Esoteric Science, and elsewhere, that to begin with certain spiritual beings worked on ancient Saturn, who had passed through their lower stages of evolution in a long distant past, and who were already so far advanced that they were able, so to speak, able to sacrifice their own corporeality to supply the foundation, the basic substance, for ancient Saturn. In the order of the hierarchies, these spiritual beings are none other than those whom we call the spirits of will. Into the substance thus provided, which had been offered as a sacrifice by the spirits of will, the other hierarchies then put their work. The spirits of personality worked their own way into it, developing their own humanity in this will substance. It was this very will substance which worked on ancient Saturn as the warmth element. And it was in this warmth that the first rudiments of the human physical body were formed. But you must not imagine that beings such as the spirits of will might stop working at a certain stage. Even though they did the bulk of the work on Saturn, they continued working during the evolutionary process on Sun, Moon, and Earth, and kept up a certain connection with the substance with which they first made their sacrifice. In fact, we saw how during the ancient Sun evolution, the element of warmth was transformed into the element of air, moving, as it were, in a downward direction toward densification. A process such as this, which appears to be a densification of warmth into air, is, nevertheless, only Maya, giving us the illusion of densification. Within this process itself, a spiritual activity is going on. and anyone wanting to get to the core of the matter has to ask which of the hierarchies brought the more rarefied warmth substance into the coarser condition of the substance of air. It was these very spirits of will who made their sacrifice in the substance of warmth. We can describe their activity by saying that during ancient Saturn evolution, they were advanced enough to be able to pour out their own substance as warmth, to offer it as a sacrifice, so that their fire streamed into the planetary existence of ancient Saturn. Then during the ancient sun existence, they condensed this, their fire, into a gaseous element. It was also they who, during the moon evolution, condensed their gaseous element to liquid. And during earth evolution, they condensed liquid still further to the earth element, to solid matter. So, when we look about us in the world today and see solid matter, we have to tell ourselves that there are the forces of beings at work in it, without which it would be utterly impossible for solid matter to exist. Forces belonging to beings whose very substance flowed forth as warmth into ancient Saturn, and they made this substance coarser and coarser until it reached the solid state, which is now firmly held together by their powerful forces. And if we want to know who it is that brings this about, if we want to look beyond the maya of solid matter, we have to say that behind everything of a solid nature, there is the active work of the spirits of will, the thrones. Thus, even in our present earthly existence, the spirits of will are still present. This throws a new light on what we are told in Genesis. When we are told that what is expressed in Genesis as bara is a kind of meditative activity of the Elohim, we have to say that the Elohim recreated out of their meditation as a kind of memory, something I have described as a complex of existence. But in a certain way, there happened to the Elohim what happens to us when we create something out of memory, though we, of course, carry out this activity at a much lower level. Let us choose a comparison. Think of a human being going to sleep in the evening. Where his own subjective consciousness is concerned, his world of thought and feeling sinks into oblivion as he passes into a condition of sleep. Suppose the last thought he had in the evening was, say, of a rose that was beside him when he fell asleep. This thought sinks into oblivion. In the morning, the thought of the rose reappears. If the rose were not still there, the person would only have the thought. You must distinguish between these two facts. The one is the calling up in memory of the image of the rose, which could occur even if the rose had been removed. So you have the thought, the memory of the rose. But if the rose is still there, you also perceive the visible rose. That is the other fact. I want you to distinguish in a similar manner these two things in which I have described, these two things in what I have described, as the cosmic meditation of the Elohim. So when we are told that on the third day of creation, a cosmic meditation takes place, and that the Elohim divide the water from the land, that they separate out the solid element and call it earth, we must also include in the picture the cosmic meditation of the Elohim, from whom this thought comes forth creatively. But in what appears in their meditations, we have to see the spirits of will at work, bringing forth yet again real being objectively from out of themselves. This is how the spirits of will work. And this is how they have worked from the beginning in everything of an earth nature. You must make yourselves familiar with such ideas. You must get used to the thought that in the things closest to us, and which we often regard as very lowly, we may meet very high and exalted beings. It is easy enough to say of the solid element that it is only matter, in quotes, and some people may be tempted to say that it is no concern of the spiritual investigator, for after all, matter is only of minor importance. Why bother with it? We rise above matter, to a spiritual level. Anyone who thinks like this is ignoring the fact that through countless ages, lofty spiritual beings have been working in the substance he wants to discredit, to bring it into this solid state. Actually, if our feeling life were to penetrate through the elemental covering of the earth, to what has made this earth covering solid, it would be the natural thing to feel the deepest reverence and the greatest respect for the exalted beings we call the spirits of will, who have labored so long in this earthly element to build the solid ground upon which we tread, and which we ourselves bear within us in the earthly constituents of our physical bodies. It is these spirits of will, whom in the Christian esotericism we also call the thrones, who have in fact constructed, or rather condensed, the solid ground upon which we walk. The esotericists who gave names to what the spirits of will created within our earth existence called these spirits thrones, because they did indeed build thrones, which all the time are supporting us and giving us a firm foundation. And upon this, all the other aspects of our earth existence will continue to be firmly and solidly, in quotes, enthroned. These old expressions have an essential quality to which our feelings can respond with the greatest respect and admiration. If we now go back up again from the solid to the watery element, we have to say that a longer time had to be spent on building up and densifying the earthly element than the watery. Therefore, we shall expect to find the fundamental forces behind the watery element belonging to beings of a lower hierarchy. For the condensation of this element into the condition it has around us today, it needed only the activity of the spirits of wisdom, curiosities or dominions, the next rank down in the hierarchies. Therefore, whereas behind our solid foundations we see the spirits of will, behind what is not physical water, but the forces which constitute the liquid element, we have to see the activity of the spirits of wisdom, or curiosities. If we go up to the airy element, we have to see the next lowest hierarchy at work, in the activity of the air around us, to the extent that it is brought about by forces lying behind them, we have also to see the effect of the activity of certain spirits of the hierarchies. Just as the spirits of wisdom work in the watery element, the spirits of movement, the dunamis, mites, as we are accustomed to call them in Christian esotericism, are at work in the air. And when we ascend to the warmth element, the next stage of rarefaction, it is the spirits of the next hierarchy lower down, the spirits of form, exousiae, who are at work there, the spirits we have been speaking of for days as the Elohim. Up to now we have been describing the spirits of form from quite a different side, namely as those who brooded in the warmth element. When we trace the order of the hierarchies from the spirits of will down through the spirits of wisdom and of movement, we once again come to our Elohim, to our spirits of form. You see how it all links up if you line them up properly. If you now try to bring sensitive and perceptive feelings into all this, you will say that at the foundation of all we see around us with our senses, there is an elemental realm. There is an element of earth, yet in reality there live within it the spirits of will. There is a fluid element in which, in truth, live the spirits of wisdom. An airy element within which, in reality, live the spirits of movement. And a warmth element wherein, in truth, live the spirits of form, the Elohim. However, we must not think that we can make a clear separation between these spheres, that we can draw rigid boundaries between them. The whole of earthly life is based on the fact that water, air, and solid matter work into one another, and that warmth permeates everything. There is nothing of a solid nature that is not in a state of warmth. We find warmth everywhere within the other levels of elemental existence. Therefore, we can also say that the activity of the Elohim, the actual force behind the element of warmth, is to be found absolutely everywhere. It has poured itself out into everything. Although it required for its very existence the activity of the spirits of will, of wisdom, and of movement, this element of warmth, which is the manifestation of the spirits of form, nevertheless interpenetrated all the other levels of existence during the earth stage. Therefore, in the solid element, we shall not only find the material basis of earth, the body of the spirits of will, but the body of the spirits of will permeated and interwoven by the Elohim themselves, the spirits of form. Let us now try to find in the sense realm the outer expression of what we have just stated. We have been describing things from the supersensible point of view, namely as an interweaving of the spirits of will, the thrones, and the spirits of form, the Elohim. This is in the supersensible realm. But everything of a supersensible nature throws its shadow image into our world of sense. How does it display itself? That which is substantially the body, the essential being of the spirits of will, is the solid matter spread out around us. The commonly accepted idea of matter is an illusion. The ideas we have of matter are Maya. When the seer turns his attention to the places where matter is supposed to lead its dubious existence, he does not find these fantastic ideas of physical matter, for those are an empty illusion. Matter, as conceived by the physicist, is pure fantasy. So long as these concepts are used merely as calculating devices, it is all right. But when people imagine they have discovered something real, they are dreaming. The theories of modern physics are, in fact, dreams. Insofar as physicists take note of facts and describe actual solid facts, for example, giving descriptions of what the eye, EYE, can see and what can be deduced from this by doing calculations, then they are on to true reality. But as soon as they begin to speculate about atoms, molecules, and so on, as if these were simply material entities, then they begin to hallucinate on a grand scale. Which reminds me of Felix Balder's Dukats in his mystery play, when he says in the temple, quote, "Fancy telling someone from whom you want to buy something, subquote, I won't pay for it with real coin, but I promise you I will condense some ducats out of the mist, and close subquote, close quote. This crude simile really does give a fair idea of the sort of theory of physics that readily accepts that whole universe can come forth from primordial mist if the need for a world view can be paid for with the coinage offered in this domain by science. It is pure fantasy to take the existence of atoms as envisaged today to be real. So long as atoms are looked upon merely as counters or shorthand notes for what the senses actually show, we keep our feet on the ground. If we want to penetrate behind the sense-perceptible layer, however, we have to rise to the realm of the spirit, where we reach the living movement of a basic substance which is none other than the bodily nature of the thrones, permeated by the activity of the spirits of form. And how is this projected into our sense world? Around us, we have an expanse of solid matter, which is at no stage amorphous, however, formlessness only results from the fact that basically all existence, pushing as it does toward form, bursts apart or is crushed. None of the dust we find in the world is dust by normal tendency. It is the result of a wearing down process. Matter as such has the urge to take on form. Everything solid tends to become crystalline. Thus we can say that what we call the substance of the thrones and of the Elohim is impelled into our sense world, announcing itself as the solid matter all around us. Through the fact of it manifesting as what we call matter, it announces itself as the essential being of the thrones. Insofar as this basic substance takes on shape and form, it announces itself as the outer revelation of the Elohim. Look with what spiritual insight names were given in ancient times. Seers of old realized, when we look at the material world, it is proclaiming itself in the substance of the thrones, but it is permeated by a force which wants to give a form to everything, hence the name Spirits of Form. In all these names there is a hint of the reality they stand for. Just look at the urge to crystallization going on around us. You have, at a lower level, the Elohim themselves, the Spirits of Form, revealing outwardly the drive they have to assume crystal form, and exercising this tremendous force and movement in the substance of the thrones. They are the smiths, forging in the warmth element the crystalline forms of the different earths and metals out of the formless substance of the spirits of will. They are the spirits who, in their activity of warmth, are at the same time the forming element of existence. When we look at things this way, we gaze into the active life stirring beneath the surface of our existence, and this accustoms us to see Maya or illusion in everything that approaches us externally. But we must not come to a standstill over the mere theory that the external world is Maya. That achieves nothing. The statement only makes sense if we penetrate through the separate aspects of Maya and find in each instance the real being behind it. This is the way to accustom ourselves to see in everything that happens around us something which, though certainly illusion, has truth in it. Semblance is, after all, semblance. As such, it is a fact. But we do not understand it if we stop at its semblance value. We are only justified in respecting and valuing it as semblance if we go beyond its appearance. In our modern abstract way of looking at things, we muddle everything up. The seers of old did no such thing. It was not so straightforward for them that they saw the same superficial forces in everything as the modern physicist does, who insists on embracing meteorology as well as physics within his sphere. For who today doubts that the same forces which are at work in elemental existence, in solid matter, fluids, and so on, are active too within the atmosphere when clouds form, when water masses into cloud? I know quite well that the modern physicist cannot help assuming that as a physicist he can aspire to be a meteorologist too, and that for him things only make sense if he applies the same laws to the formation of the watery masses that surround our earth as clouds as he does to earthly existence. To the seer, things are not as simple as that. As soon as things are traced back to their spiritual sources, you cannot expect to see the same thing everywhere. Different forces are at work when a form of gas condenses to liquid directly onto the earth, then are at work when gas or vapor forms watery cumuli. When contemplating the way water arises in the atmosphere around us, the seer cannot say that water comes into being there in exactly the same way as it does on the ground. That the water hovering above us comes into existence in the same way as water condenses in the soil or on the ground itself. For the truth is that the beings who play their part in cloud formation are different from those who are active in the formation of water. What I have just been saying regarding the participation of the hierarchies in our elemental existence applies only on the earth from its center up to where we ourselves stand. But the same forces do not suffice to form the clouds as well. Other beings are at work there. The scientific theory derived from modern physics is based on a very simple hypothesis. First, it discovers certain physical laws, and then it says that these laws apply to the whole of existence. It overlooks all the differences in the different spheres of existence. It acts on the principle that in the night all cows are gray, but things are not the same everywhere. They are very different in the different domains. Anyone who has become aware through clairvoyant investigation that on our earth the thrones or the spirits of will govern the earth element, the spirits of wisdom the watery element, the spirits of movement the aeriform element, and the Elohim the element of warmth, will gradually come to realize that in the gathering of the clouds, in that unique process going on in the circumference of our earth, in which the watery vapor turns to water, beings belonging to the hierarchy of the cherubim are at work. When we look at the solid matter of our elemental existence, we see the Elohim cooperating with the thrones. When we look upward to the airy element, even though it is governed by the spirits of movement, we see the cherubim at work in it, so that the water rising up from the realm of the spirits of wisdom can accumulate as clouds. It is just as true that the cherubim govern the earth's surroundings as it is true that the thrones, the spirits of wisdom, and the spirits of movement govern the elemental existence on our earth. If we now look into the active essence of these cloud formations themselves, into their hidden depths, which are only revealed now and then, we are aware of lightning and thunder coming forth. This is not something which comes from nothing. The seer knows that the spirits whom we call the seraphim move and have their being in this activity. Remaining within the limits of our earth sphere, including the circumference of our earth, we have now found every one of the hierarchical ranks. Thus, in what we experience with our senses, we see the manifestations of hierarchical activity. It would be utter nonsense to imagine that what you see when lightning flashes forth from the clouds is the same as what you see when you strike a match. Every time electricity, the element active in lightning, comes forth from matter, quite different forces are at work, namely, the seraphim. So, we can find the totality of the hierarchies in the earth's environment, just as we can find them out there in the cosmos. For the hierarchies, as we see, also extend their activity to what is in our immediate environment. When you go through the pages of Genesis and look at the mighty course of world evolution depicted there, you discover that all the previous stages taking place during the ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon existences are being repeated, and that man finally emerges as the crowning achievement of evolution. We have to realize that Genesis is telling us that the being and activity of all the hierarchies is engaged in what is occurring there, and that it is all being concentrated, as it were, on the final product of Earth evolution, that supersensible being, for initially it was supersensible, of whom it is said that the Elohim resolved to create it, saying, quote, "Let us make man," close quote. They wove together all their separate talents into one communal activity. All the abilities which they brought with them from earlier stages were woven together so as finally to create man. Indeed, all the hierarchies who preceded man and whom we call seraphim, cherubim, thrones, spirits of wisdom, spirits of movement and spirits of form, archai, or spirits of personality, fire spirits, or archangels, and angels. We have found all of them. They all moved and had their being in all that existed. And if we follow the Genesis account up to the crowning of the structure on the sixth day of creation, with the appearance of man, if we review the whole life and essence of pre-human earthly evolution, we find that all the various hierarchies are already there. All of these hierarchies had to join forces to prepare what finally appeared as man. Thus we may venture to say that the seer or seers among whom Genesis arose were aware that all the hierarchies we have named had to contribute to the preparatory stage of man. But they also had to be aware that for the creation of man himself, for the final crowning of this whole sequence of the hierarchies, help had to come from another direction, one that is still higher in a certain respect than any of these hierarchies. So we turn our gaze beyond the seraphim to an as yet unknown and only dimly sensed divine being. Let us try for a moment to follow up the activity of one of the members of the hierarchical order, the Elohim, let us say. Before they had reached the decision to crown their works by creating man, it sufficed for them to work in harmony with the activity of the other hierarchies up to the seraphim. But then help had to come from the direction to which, out of a dim presentiment, we have to lift our spiritual gaze. It had to come from a realm above that of the seraphim, for the Elohim to raise their creative activity to these dizzy heights, to obtain help from this source. Something had to occur, the significance of which we want to try to understand. They had, so to speak, to grow beyond themselves. They had to acquire a greater ability than was theirs during the preparatory stages of the work. To crown their work completely and carry it through to the finish, the Elohim had to unfold still higher powers. The Elohim as a group had to grow beyond themselves. Let us try to form an idea of how such a thing can happen, and do this by making use of a rather humble illustration. Take the development of a human being. When we see a tiny child on the threshold of earthly existence, we know that he has not yet developed what we call an integrated consciousness. It is only after some time that he even calls himself I, which brings unity into the consciousness. It is only then that the contents of his soul life become knit together in an integrated consciousness. The child grows to a further stage through the drawing together of the various activities which in the baby are still decentralized. Thus in the human being this drawing together signifies an advance to a higher stage. We can think of the progressive development of the Elohim as analogous to this. During the preparatory stages of human creation, they learned a certain activity. Whilst performing this activity, they themselves learned something and contributed something toward raising themselves to a higher stage. As a group, they have now attained to a kind of unified consciousness. They have not remained simply a group, but they have become a unity. This unity became a kind of being. This fact is an extremely important one. Up to now, I was only able to tell you that the various Elohim each had his own special capacity. Each of them was able to contribute something to the common resolve, the common image of the human being they wanted to form. And yet, this was still only an idea upon which they could cooperate. To begin with, it was not real. Something real existed only after they had created the common product. But in the course of this work itself, they developed to a higher stage. They made their unity a reality, so that they were no longer seven, but a sevenfold whole. We can now speak of an Elohimhood, which reveals itself in a sevenfold way. This Elohimhood only arose in course of time. The Elohim raised themselves to this level. The Bible knows this. The Bible recognizes the idea that the Elohim were previously members of a group and then formed themselves into a unity. That first they cooperated as members of a group and were later on governed by a common organism. And this real unity of Elohim, in which the single Elohim are active as organs of a body, is called in the Bible Jehovah Elohim. This gives us a more profound idea of Jehovah than was possible before. This is why the Bible at first speaks simply of the Elohim, and then, when the Elohim themselves have progressed to a higher stage, to a unity, it starts speaking of Jehovah Elohim. This is the deeper reason why, at the end of the book of creation, the name of Jehovah suddenly appears. This shows how necessary it is to have recourse to occult sources if one wants to understand such things. What does Bible criticism of the 19th century make of this? It says, we find in one passage the name Elohim, and in another the name Jehovah. Clearly the two passages derive from two different religious traditions, and we have to distinguish between what has come from a people who worship the Elohim and what has come from a people who worship Jehovah. And the person who wrote the account of creation used both names indiscriminately, and we have to separate them again. This line of research has gone so far that today we have so-called, quote, rainbow Bibles, close quote, with what is said to derive from the one source printed in blue and what comes from the other printed in red. There are such Bibles. Only, unfortunately, sometimes the antecedent is blue and the final clause red, because the first part of the sentence is said to derive from one people and the rest of it from the other. It is astonishing that the main and subordinate clauses should fit so beautifully together that any old collator could combine them. Bible commentators have gone to great pains over this, perhaps more so than over any other scientific or historical research. But it only fills us with sadness and a deep sense of tragedy. An account which is meant to tell us about the most profound spiritual matters has lost its connection with its spiritual source and origin. It is as though someone were to say, quote, we find quite a different style in the second part of Faust if we compare the passage containing the words of Ariel with the doggerel in part one. It is impossible that one and the same person could have written them both. Therefore, Goethe must be a mythical figure. Close quote. Through being cut off from occult sources, the fruit of this immense and devoted labor is worth as much as the conclusion of someone who denies the existence of Goethe because he cannot believe that two such different things as the style of Faust Part I and Faust Part II could have been written by the same person. This gives us a glimpse into a deep tragedy of human life, one that stresses the necessity that minds should again turn to the sources of spiritual life. Spiritual knowledge will only be possible if people set out once more in search of the living spirit. They will do so, for to do so is an irresistible urge of the human soul. And all the strength with which anthroposophy can inspire us comes from our confidence that there is this urge in the human soul activating our hearts to seek once again for a connection with spiritual sources, and which will bring us to understand the true basis of religious documents. Let us fill ourselves with this confidence, and then we shall reap the genuine fruits of a theme which should lead us to the living spirit. The end of Lecture 6.